Welcome back to the BizNews Rugby Show. As always, joined by our BizNews Rugby Insider and as well as Tim Cocker, a regular on the show now, and our Investec Champions Cup pundit. Before we get into this week's semi-finals, I feel like it might be a good idea just to check how we got here. It's been a couple of weeks since we've been in the Investec Champions Cup, so it might be wise to just give some thoughts on the quarterfinals from 2 or 3 weeks ago, I think it was.
Yeah, well, you and I have unpacked these, but I'm very, very keen to hear Tim's thoughts, Patrick. And thanks for the introduction. Good morning or good afternoon, whenever this flights BizNews tribe. The reason I asked my friend Tim Cocker from Egg Chasers Rugby to get onto this show is precisely as Patrick says, we've now had 2 weeks of a URC since the quarterfinals of the Investec Champions Cup. And now we're straight into the finals. Massive weekend in Dublin and in Bordeaux coming up. And while I follow it as closely as I can, Tim is immersed in this because what we have are the, well, I'm getting ahead of myself, but we have the reigning Premier League champions moving up to Dublin to play the mighty Leinster, hell-bent on making sure that they don't mess up another final in Dublin, as well as the mighty Toulouse, Stade Toulousain, crossing across French soil and vineyards to Bordeaux to play their semi-final on Sunday. So with that introduction, Tim, a massive welcome back to you. As ever, I gave you almost no notice, and as ever, we so appreciate your time. Egg Chasers Rugby has become massively popular, but especially so in South Africa. I believe that there must be many among our BizNews tribe that follow you. For those who haven't seen it, get onto Tim's channel and have a look at the most recent post where he talks about what's going on at Exeter Chiefs. The Premiership, and as he puts it, rugby in general, is in a lot of trouble, other than in France and with Springbok rugby. But everywhere else, rugby is struggling, and that just really hurts me as a rugby tragic and passionate supporter. So, Tim, with that introduction, good morning to you in the UK where the sun is out, as you've just told us. And thank you again for your time. We so appreciate it. How are you?
Absolutely my pleasure. I'm very, very well. I'm pleased to be back on. And to pick up on what Patrick was talking about with you, I mean, you've laid out where we are with the Champions Cup. There's also the Challenge Cup semi-finals, which again, sadly, unlike the Sharks won it last year, but there's no South African representation in the latter stages of either competition this year. But the Sharks are, for the time being, the reigning holders. But after you've set up the semi-finals so well, to pick up on what Patrick said, where we've come from in the quarterfinals was some uncomfortably one-sided matches. It's been a bit of a disappointment with this competition. And I know you're very well aware of that, Rory, because you had skin in the game on the game in Dublin where Leinster just took it to another place against Glasgow Warriors, holders of the URC, and 52-0 was a statement, really. And I think you've captured it perfectly when you said that Leinster are hell-bent on not messing up again, and they've had too many years of being runners-up in this competition, three in a row. They've had their focus purely on the Champions Cup and missed out on potential URC titles as well. And to go with that, yeah, whilst they're not doing very well in the Premiership, the current Premiership champions are going really well in the Champions Cup, and Northampton Saints beat Castra in the last round comfortably at home, again scoring over 50 points. Bordeaux nearly scored 50 against Munster in dispatching them relatively comfortably. And the only game where it was in the balance in the final moments was in Toulon in an all-French battle where Toulouse, the current holders of the Champions Cup, just came through with a penalty kick in the dying moments. And I guess that's the first place to start. Is I hope that these are really competitive games that are in the balance for as much of it as possible. I've got a feeling that won't be the case, though.
Yeah, and you know, you've been saying regularly, Tim, that part of the problem with rugby in general and rugby in Europe is the fact that we constantly have these runaway scores, whereas previously when it was the Heineken Cup or the Heineken Champions Cup, the games were so much tighter because the quality of rugby was that much better. And as you've said, that 21-18 win by Toulouse over Toulon away from home, they played in Toulon, was 18 all up until I think the 79th or 80th minute, and up stepped Tomas Ramos, and he kicked that penalty to take them into a 3-point win. But it could so easily have been Toulon traveling to Bordeaux, on the weekend. So before I ask you to walk us through those two games, Tim, how do you see Leinster's chances in the URC as well as in the Champions Cup? Have you got any inkling as to what they're going to do? Obviously, they want to prioritize the Champions Cup because they've lost three. But, they've been caught by surprise by, amongst others, the Bulls in the URC. What's your feeling on how are they going to play these two championships? Because they're in the sharp end of both.
I suspect, firstly, their squad is incredibly deep. So they've shown in the URC, whilst they lost against Scarlets at the weekend, they have shown that they can rotate almost an entire team and it's still good enough to comfortably put away many a URC team. But I think one stat I'll just draw your attention to, since Jordy Barrett has arrived there in December, he has played only three times in the URC. And I think that will change now and for the rest of the season. In previous years, they've tried to rotate as they go through this semi-final, back to URC final, back to URC playoffs. They've tried to rotate. I suspect you're going to see a much more consistent selection from Leinster because they have wrapped up their superstars and their island internationals. And RG Snaiman, when you look at his minutes, he's not played that many. He's played in more games than Jordy Barrett, but the actual minutes on the field have not been that much. I think that is going to shift. And I think they've wrapped their players in cotton wool so that they can have as many of them on the pitch for as much of the next month or so as possible, because they want both of these competitions. But there's no doubt that the Champions Cup, that fifth star above their crest, which they've missed out on three times in the most heartbreaking of circumstances, extra time, by a single point to La Rochelle a couple of times, they want that badly. And it's been nine years since their last title, and they're, I don't think they're going to leave anything to chance in trying to make sure that they get that fifth star this year. And I think they're very, very well placed to do so with the acquisitions that they've got. Snaiman and Barrett have just taken them to another level.
I agree. So with Rico Ioane coming over to replace Jordy Barrett when he goes back, does Jordy's 6-month contract with them extend to beyond the final of the Champions Cup term? So will he be there for, let's say they make both finals, will he be there to play for both, or will Rico Ioane be coming in during that time?
No, I'm pretty sure it's going to be the same as with Rico Ioane as it is with Jordy Barrett. Rico Ioane will join after the November tests when they're up north playing, and then he will join till the end of the season. So yeah, Jordy Barrett would be available for a URC semi-final and final. Assuming they get to both of those, yeah.
And before we examine the two games, Tim, what do you think it will say about Leinster should they win both?
Well, first and foremost, it will just say that they are the most impressive squad probably in world rugby, and they've fallen short at the final hurdle, and I think that's more so the case now. I don't know, and a lot is made about, well, we don't know how much Leinster spend. We know that there is a salary cap that exists in South Africa and in France and in England, so you can kind of work out what the cost of assembling that squad is. We don't know what the cost of assembling Leinster's squad is. That said, almost all of their players, save for a few of those guys from New Zealand that came over, save for Barrett and Snaiman, these are all locally grown lads from the school system and an academy system in Leinster. It is amazing. Only, as you've already touched on, only South Africa can boast a production line of young talent that Leinster have got. And it's that that has got them to this point. And that means that two, three in every position almost are
It's so impressive. It really is so impressive from a population of, what is Ireland? Is it 3 million people?
I think maybe the whole of the island of Ireland, north and south, is five. So probably 4 million. Yeah, three and a half million.
In the Republic of Ireland. And they produce that quality. Whereas since you compared it to South Africa, we have such a glut of schoolboy talent coming through that we are able to, one, export a lot of it, and two, a lot of the boys just stop playing, you know, after school. Some of them go on to Varsity Cup and they don't go, you know, don't go on from there. And yet this little country, the Emerald Isle, have just maximized every iota, every millimeter, every milligram of talent that they've got to produce this team, which, as you say, is arguably already up there with Toulouse. I mean, Toulouse have got 6 stars above their badge. Leinster are probably going to win 5, their 5th. So it's extraordinary. And as I was pointing out last week, Tim, I don't know whether you watched that interview, but David Nucifora, the former Australian international, is credited with establishing and putting that pipeline in place in Ireland. And he's just come across to Scotland to hopefully do the same thing, because Scotland are struggling and their population is about the same. I think Scotland is also about 5 or 5.5 million, mainly football fans. Well, certainly in Glasgow, they're mainly football fans. And so he's been given the task of trying to establish a similar pipeline, because Scottish rugby's youth teams are nowhere near as good as the other Six Nations, you know, countries. So there's hope there that if it is Nucifora's genius that was able to put that in place, well, then let's hope he's able to replicate that in Scotland. And we see, you know, this great Scottish team that we have at the moment just going on to bigger and better things.
Do you know what? A really interesting point about David Nucifora, as you talked about, and young Irish players. I forget who it was. I think it might have been Gordon Darcy, the old Ireland centre. When I worked with him on a game, I think it was him, he said the biggest difference between young Irish players coming through the academy and school system there and, say, English or Scottish or based on what he sees, is they'll all dutifully do what the coach says, but the Irish player will also ask why. So that their kind of their understanding of rugby, the way their rugby brains work, they just on a deeper level. And I think you see that with some of the players that come through. Guys like Caelan Dorris, who, yeah, he's got great physical attributes, but he's just got a rugby brain that elevates him to another level. So, yeah, if they can replicate that, then, yeah, good luck, Scotland.
What an interesting observation, because South African fans will remember that back in the days of the Tri Nations, before it became the Rugby Championship, and you had that exceptionally good Australian team, you know, the era of Gregan and Larkham and Horan and Little and the rest of them, Australians were always a very cerebral side. They could outthink teams. And they used a little bit of sledging, of course, as part of their armory. But they were very, very good at thinking rugby and understanding it if they didn't necessarily have the power base, based on the fact that rugby union was only the 3rd most popular overall sport in their country. So that's a very good observation, Tim. Thanks for that.
Yeah, pleasure.
Okay, mate. So why don't you walk us through what's going to happen at the Aviva when, as I said, defending premiership champions Northampton Saints head up to Dublin?
Well, I fear that what's going to happen is another team is going to go to Dublin and be overpowered in the way that Glasgow were. The relentlessness of the physical challenge, the breakdown challenge, the speed of ball, the quality of players, I just cannot see Northampton matching up. Although I said the same last year, and Northampton in this exact same fixture, a semi-final in Dublin, they managed to finish within 7 points and give a really good account of themselves. The way that Northampton play, I guess this fixture, with them being heavy underdogs, could actually play in their favour, because they are at their best when they throw caution to the wind a little bit and let those players, I mean, some guys in red hot form, Alex Mitchell, Finn Smith, Tommy Freeman, Ollie Slightholme, all England internationals recently who played very well during the Six Nations. Unfortunately, no George Furbank. That's been confirmed as he's out injured for the week. But that back line, it can fizz on its day. Can the forwards get a platform for them? Well, one matchup there that's really, really interesting to watch is young, prodigious talent. You know, you've got Sacha Feinberg and Gomzulu, who's tearing it up at the minute. In England, we've got Henry Pollock. And the kind of the confidence of the lad and the performance he's putting in on his England debut and for Northampton Saints this year, it's been a breakout year for him. He goes up against Josh van der Fleer, who everybody has been thinking for years he's the guy that's going to wear the 7 jersey for the British and Irish Lions this summer. Incredibly, Josh van der Fleer has never been a British and Irish Lion. It just seems mad to think that, a former World Player of the Year. I know, never been. So that matchup alone, Josh van der Vleer desperately trying to get on his first Lions tour. Henry Pollock probably going into it thinking, Josh who? That jersey's mine. That's going to be really, really fun to watch. I think Josh van der Vleer might be the one celebrating at the end of 80 minutes, though.
I think so. I think you're right, Tim. And you answered my question before I even asked it, because what we saw during the Six Nations, especially when Borthwick put, first of all, Marcus Smith to the bench and then played him at 15 to introduce Finn Smith, precisely because there was such a predominant presence of Northampton Saints in that English backline. So you've spoken about Pollock, and I just am interested in your thoughts on the rest of the pack. But Pollock made his debut, as you've said, at number 8 for England in the Six Nations. Does he play? He plays on the side of the scrum for Northampton Saints, right? So who's their 8?
Yeah, their 8 is Juano Augustus, who will be well known to many a South African fan. Yeah, a really like heavy traffic ball carrier. And he's the kind of guy that can be the best player on the pitch. And then he can be hot and cold a little bit. But when he's on, he's a scary talent. And yeah, Henry Pollock is, I think he's an out-and-out 7, an English 7, a South African 6, a fetcher, a breakdown threat. But he just runs those really good support lines. He always seems to pop up in the right place at the right time, which is just the sign of one of those special talents of the people that things just happen when they're on the field. So watching him is great. As for the rest of the Northampton pack, last year when they won the Premiership, they had Courtney Laws and Lewis Ludlam, and they previously had Dave Ribbons, and they had Alex Waller, who's a bit of a club legend. So they've had lots of international standard players who have left the forwards, and it's young guys that are trying to fill their places. That is the salary cap system in England. That's the financial constraints that there are. And I mean, again, I don't know how much Leinster's squad would be to assemble, and they've produced the players themselves, so it's fair play to them, whatever that is. But I would imagine it's probably at least double or triple is what you would need to spend to if you were doing it like for like. And I think that probably tells the picture of this team. That said, it's only 15 guys or 23 guys that are going head-to-head, so on any given Sunday and all that, we'll see.
And no team is unbeatable, because once you cross the whitewash into that turf between the four white lines, that's what it's all about.
Just ask Leinster.
Just ask Leinster. Exactly right. I wanted to just stand still there on Mr. Ribbons, if I may, because he was unbelievable in that quarterfinal, that Saints won. And he is South African born, but is he already capped for England? Can we grab him back? Because that's the kind of guy I think I would love to have join the Springbok Lock Factory. How does his national, international kind of rugby citizenship stand?
Well, I think yes is the answer to your question. He could play for South Africa again. I think he would qualify in just under a year's time, or around about a year's time. So 2026, he could represent South Africa again. He was in the England World Cup squad, in fact. So he played in the third, fourth place playoff against Argentina. So that would be his last international match for England. So I think it's a 3-year stand down period. So he could be, and I wouldn't bet against this happening, he could be for South Africa what John Klein was during the last World Cup, obviously having previously played for Ireland, then re-qualified for South Africa. And I mean, I'm hoping that maybe the English eligibility rules might change before then. That said, I always prefer players playing for their homeland, or, you know, because Dave Ribbons qualified on residency rather than through a parent. It would be lovely. As much as I'd love to see him back up wearing the rose, it would be a really cool story to see him playing for the Box.
Thanks, Tim. I was mightily impressed. I knew very little about him. You know, you'd heard the odd comment and you read the odd write-up, but when I watched that full 80 minutes, he was blooming brilliant, man, in that quarterfinal. Okay, so Patrick, we move to the all French derby. The mighty Stade Toulousain, as I've said, got to go across to grape and wine country in Bordeaux, as if there's not other grape and wine countries in between. But Tim, what do you see here? Because they, as we said, almost stumbled in Toulon, but these guys just know how to win playoffs, don't they? Even without DuPont.
Yeah, although you cannot underestimate the impact that no DuPont has had. I think it was put to me by someone who knows French rugby very, very well. Toulouse have such a unique way of playing that it would have to be a truly world-class scrum half that could come in and play the Toulouse way. And consequently, because those kind of players are not available, that they're all under contract elsewhere, they have had to go with what they have, which is Saito, a young Japanese scrum half who was their third choice, or a young academy lad, or this lad Paul Grauel. So that it's a massive drop off in quality, and everything went through Antoine Dupont. So, and what the people were expecting to see was that Roman Untermack, who's a pretty handy player as well, would take the reins a little bit more. It just hasn't felt quite the same. And they have clicked in patches, but they just aren't quite the same force. So Bordeaux will fancy their chances. That said, I think where the matchup comes, Bordeaux struggle to handle a team with as much power as Toulouse can bring. And when you have Emmanuel Mayafu, who is, I mean, talk about locks in form, he is just red hot at the minute. Emmanuel Mayafu, you've got a monstrous front row. Guys like Cyril Bai, you've got Marchand and Malvaca as the hookers. Jack Willis, huge game for him with British and Irish Lions selection in the balance as well. Toulouse will be favourites despite the fact they're playing away in Bordeaux.
Well, they'll still be the favourites. That's interesting, Tim. And I'm with you. I really, really hope that Jacques Willis gets the nod to go on that British and Irish Lions tour down under, having been denied further England caps because he plays for Toulouse. The only problem, of course, is that there could be some fixture conflict, couldn't there, Tim, in the top 14, because the top 14's business end kind of overlaps with the Lions tour down under, yeah?
The final of the top 14, and this is the same reason why France will be not sending players, a lot of their top players, to New Zealand for the test matches, as much of a shame as that is the final of the top 14 is the 28th of June. It is a non-stop grind. It's the top 14 season. The league season is 26 games. Then there's three playoff rounds as well. So it's a 9-month season, solid. And I mean, it earns a lot of money. But even, funnily enough, just aside from the Champions Cup, even the players have started saying, I think Roman Untermack in an interview said, you know, it would be an absolute honour and he would love to go and play in South Africa and in New Zealand. And the players have started making noises that may well move the needle for the top 14 to rearrange their season so that they can get these big Southern Hemisphere, Northern Hemisphere July test match series going, which would be awesome.
Well, and that's a big call, Tim, because rugby officialdom, back to Will Carling's old farts comment, have typically been very, very resistant to that kind of progressive thinking, and especially so in France, right? I mean, the French leagues bring in so much money, they're by far the most successful domestic leagues in world rugby, and they're just going to dig their heels in, won't they?
Yeah, it's worth a lot of cash, and it would, at some point, one turkey has to vote for Christmas in order to sort this season out. I mean, Rassi Erasmus has actually came up with a brilliant idea. I think we've touched on it briefly before, where the rugby championship happens at the same time as the Six Nations through February and March to kind of bring those in line and therefore open up possibilities in the calendar elsewhere. And so, yeah, once again, it's left to people like Rassi Erasmus to kind of come up with the innovation and solve the potential issues that rugby has got many of. But actually, whether the guys in blazers, the old farts, whether they actually pull their finger out and do it, that's another question.
Yeah. And to my mind, that is a no-brainer, that the rugby championship overlaps with the Six Nations. Even if you push the Six Nations maybe 2 weeks later, you know, make it kind of not quite start in the last week of January and into early February, but make it start mid-February and push it along a little bit to, you know, to accommodate the slow start up in the Southern Hemisphere. I think that must happen at some point, Tim, as you say, just to free up, because South African players, like we said last time, are basically playing a 12-month season, and that's never going to, you know, there's no longevity or what's the politically correct word that everybody always talks about
when they
talk about playing? Sustainability. Thank you, sir.
And I'm interested actually in what the mindset is in South Africa towards the, because we're used to it up north, this kind of flipping back and forth from competition to competition. And you look at the football season and they go Premier League, Champions League, and then they might have an FA Cup match. So it's kind of normal, but it's, you look at the current Super Rugby season, they have that one short block. It's the same happening in Japan, that one block, and then it's done and it's all self-contained. Whereas it must be strange for South African rugby fans to kind of follow this hopping around competition to competition. One goes away for a month and then comes back.
It's so difficult for us, Tim. It's so foreign to be playing rugby in the heat of a summer when we normally have cricket games and the whole of the country's on leave, as you know. South Africa starts shutting down somewhere in the second or third week of November, and then we're into summer and we have our Christmas holidays. And as I say, that's always cricket season. And then into, you know, the schools and the universities reopening in January and February. But to be playing rugby through that time is so foreign. And we are already only now coming to grips with this URC format. We have yet to come to grips with the EPCR and the Investec Champions Cup and thrown all of that in there. So we are so used to the cadence with our international seasons of, you know, you start off with Varsity Cup and Supersport Challenge, and then move that into Curry Cup. Then you head into, you know, what used to be Super Rugby, and the international season kind of plonked in August, September, if not June and July. And then you taper off towards the end of it for those teams that have reached the playoffs, and you're done by October. That was always the way it was. So, I mean, if there's a time to introduce a global season and coincide the rugby championship with the Six Nations, then let's do it now while we still got our heads actually focused on, okay, rugby, the rugby landscape is all new. So if you're going to make changes, make them now. Don't do this bits and pieces thing, because it's foreign to us. And I think that this is just a personal, I'm almost thinking out loud, Tim, that while ever Springbok rugby is where it is and we're number one in the world, folks are not going to mind so much. But let me tell you, if Springbok rugby starts to decline for whatever reason, there will be a lot of fans asking a lot of questions of the officials. Why did you allow this or that to happen? So it's not without risk, but I do think, as a rugby man, I think that we have to align the international game, just like soccer has done. Yeah, I do think that's necessary.
Well, it makes so much sense, because if you take those November tests, and again, those, your BOC players can have a bit of time with their family while the weather's amazing in South Africa, and not have to travel on a grueling tour up north. That also means the Premiership or Top 14 or whatever can be compressed a little bit, because you can use that month to get some more games played, so the season finishes earlier. And then all of a sudden, we would be looking at, you know, whilst the British and Irish Lions is the main event this summer, we'd be looking forward to New Zealand against France, full bore, three test series, old school style. And maybe, you know, France would come to South Africa and do the same thing in July. And it's so simple that you just know they won't do it.
Exactly. And we're talking about world rugby, aren't we? And they are just, some of the stuff they do is just unbelievably stupid. And you've been very, very good at pointing that out, sometimes to the detriment of your own media status with world rugby, Tim. I just want to quickly come back to what you were saying about Le Petit Général. And because, you know, it's not just DuPont and not just Toulouse. The way French rugby plays is their backline plays off nine. And when you watch it, you know, as a rugby pundit to try and understand it, we all know that rugby plays off 10. And in fact, the 12 in many ways becomes the second playmaker. In French rugby, the 10 is, I wouldn't say he's almost irrelevant, because a fly-off will never be irrelevant. But the way that DuPont picks the ball up and runs with it, and then the players run off him, as you said, it's so difficult to replicate. But I don't know whether other countries could do that. I mean, we had Fourie de Preez, which in my mind, and that of Eddie Jones, as you know, was the greatest nine possibly other than DuPont. I mean, Farid Depreux was so special because of his rugby brain. He could probably do that. I just can't see. You look at the four South African scrum halves, you know, Williams, Hendrikse, Pfaff, and Herschel Yankees, and you can throw a few others in there. I don't think they can do that. You need Pollard. You need Mani Leboka. Now, Sasha FM there. I can't see. Maybe Pfaff could do it because he's played fly off, you know, where they pick the ball up and run 2, 3, 4, 5 steps before they spin a pass out. That's what DuPont is so brilliant at. What are your comments on that? I mean, do English nines play like that?
No. The English nines are there to get to the ball and get the ball away within a structured system. What's amazing, I was in France last week and I ended up playing, after a conversation in a pub the night before, I ended up playing a game for, it's the way these things go, I ended up playing for an English touring team who were short of numbers against a French team. And it was amazing being on the pitch and even at, you know, a low level, seeing how ingrained it is in the culture that players just react on the field, and they are coached, and it's in the DNA. The difference and the unique thing about French rugby is that everyone reacts in the moment. And so when you have a player like DuPont, just kind of almost like a matador, just sort of stepping, teasing, testing edges and things, and players just don't run through moves and structures in quite the same way as they do with English, where it's very structured. Kick, shape, it looks the same. French rugby is completely different, and it's hard to even explain. But they just when the moment happens, they just go, and it's a bit of instinct, and it's a bit more of that artistry comes in, which is very stereotypical, stereotypically French, but they're all coached like that from a really young age. They're all very comfortable ball in hand. They're all really understand running lines. And when someone makes a line break, they instinctively flood through that gap. And it's just really, really fun. It's really fun to watch. It makes for really good matchups when you come up, you know, France against England or South Africa with the power game. It makes a really interesting matchup. But DuPont is the absolute fulcrum of that. And everyone at Toulouse reacts to him. And so without him, yeah, it's huge.
And it's those running lines, isn't it, Tim? Because it's all very well to say a nine picks the ball up and runs 3 or 4 paces, but if he hasn't got 2 or 3 options, it's never going to work, because a flank like Peter Seffi is just going to shut him down. But it does work because you've got the fly off and the centers choosing lines, running at space. You've probably got the blind side wing coming in from somewhere that gives him an option to offload to. And there's a number 8 or the flank of whichever side of the field is as well, a little inside flick to those guys. And once it starts to run, it looks like a Swiss clock. And DuPont is just so good because he always chooses the right runner to flick the offload to, or throws a dummy. And he's got the power and the pace to break a tackle and then offload it. And that's what makes him so dangerous.
Yeah, I totally agree. But then again, whilst the playmakers in South Africa and England are mainly the fly halves, and in most countries, the really, really good fly halves, you mentioned André Pollard, we could talk about Sacha Feinberg and Gomzulu in the same light as well. They are the ones who, how many times do you see a line break happen and then you look back and you see André Pollard on his back because he's just been walloped? He's willing to take it that flat to the line, take the hit in order to put someone else through. And so it's different tactics, but it's the same qualities. The player that can engage the defence and see the right option. And those are the great players, whatever number they're wearing.
Right. And so that's just another dimension to look forward to in that semi-final on Sunday, Tim, because we do have Toulouse, who you've called, and I defer to your better knowledge of French rugby, you've called them still the favourites, but they will be without their general. And Bordeaux have been playing some absolutely beautiful and superb rugby. They've got Labib Beep. They've got that back line is so poisonous.
Maxime Luku, Matthew Jalabert, Yoram Moafana, Damien Penno, Louis Bielbiere, and watch out for the fullback Romain Bourros. He's a proper talent as well. So it's stacked with French internationals, flair everywhere, pace. So they can just end the game at one quiet 10-minute period and it's all over. But Bordeaux are coming off the back of a defeat at the weekend. I watched the game against La Rochelle and they were just out-muscled and they looked really, really poor. So that will be a bit of a morale, a dent to their morale. So we'll see if they can bounce back.
I was going to ask that because I did not see that game nor the highlights, Tim. And, you know, La Rochelle, we know the size of their pack, Skelton and company. And you already mentioned the 150 kg on the hoof, Mia Fu, coming. So is it as simple as to say it's a battle between those lightning backs of Bordeaux and the power up front of Toulouse without DuPont pulling the strings? Or is that too simplistic?
Yeah, well, I mean, I say this quite a lot on the channel. Rugby is a really complex game, but it's also very, very simple. And physical domination makes rugby an incredibly simple game. And so I do think that's where the game will be won and lost, albeit, well, I think the kick badly to Bordeaux and you are in big trouble.
Tim, thank you so very, very much, mate. Can't tell you how much it means to always just be able to send a WhatsApp and the answer comes back. Of course, we love talking rugby and today's been an absolutely brilliant chat. We look forward to having you out here pretty soon when the box player in Italy comes out. We love you in this country and your legion of fans will be looking forward to having you back. Patrick, thank you for doing the technical stuff, boys, and we'll review everything on Monday in our newsletter, but what a great semi-final in the Investec Champions Cup. And final word to you, Tim, give us a quick rundown of the EPCR because we haven't even touched on that. Tell us what's happening in the EPCR as we say goodbye.
Yes, we have an all-French affair between Lyon and Racing 92. And in the other semi-final, that's two teams that are in the middle of the log in the top 14. One of them could emerge and get themselves a trophy. Edinburgh against Bath is really intriguing. Edinburgh at home looks like they're going to miss out on the URC playoffs. Bath are top of the Premiership. So that in itself is an interesting battle to kind of see. There's a lot of arguments about what's the better league. And Stephen Donald came out and said that the URC is a very, very low level. Well, let's see what a mid-table URC team does against the best that England have to offer in Edinburgh. I think possibly the two away teams may win that, Bath and Racing, which would set up an interesting final where Finn Russell for Bath is going up against Owen Farrell for Racing 92, which would be quite an interesting matchup. But really, really good and always a pleasure anytime. And I honestly, Rory, cannot tell you how I can't wait to get back to SA. It's been too long.
I believe you, mate. Well, thank you so much for that, Tim. And thank you again, Patrick. Biz News Tribe in. Enjoy settling in for another great weekend of rugby and don't forget about the EPCR. I'm not sure how much of that is televised, but certainly we'll be seeing the Investec Champions Cup semi-finals. Northampton Saints travelling to Dublin to the Aviva Stadium. Should be 35,000-40,000 people in there, as well as Stade Toulousain with their 6 Champions Cup wins, trying to defend that, going across to Bordeaux with their electric, poisonous backline. What a great weekend to look forward to. Thank you both, and we'll see you at the next Scrum Down.
Rory Steyn is our BizNews Rugby Insider. Tim Cocker from Egg Chasers Rugby, our go-to man for everything European rugby. And I'm Patrick Kitt from BizNews.com.